Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm tempted to say kia ora to greet you in the language of my homeland, or bonsoir, good evening. It's very exciting to be here, and of course it's an honor to engage with the arts as part of this series of lectures. As the Vice-Chancellor pointed out, we've been dealing with sciences and social sciences up until now. And when there are debates about the hard sciences and the soft sciences, which of course we in the humanities often hear, I'm always tempted to respond talking about the hard arts. So I would like this evening to talk about hard arts, and to be doing so in this great room of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce. Let's not forget those two other names that are tagged onto the title of this room, is very exciting. To be speaking amongst these paintings by Irishman James Barry, whom I gather was the first and one of the few people ever to be expelled from the Royal Academy of Arts, and to be doing this on St. Patrick's Day is really pushing the limit. It's very exciting. So my lecture, as it says, is about theatre, live art, and the Skinner biotope. This last term, I realise, is the one you're the least familiar with, so I thought I'd lift the veil on it fairly quickly, because it's going to come back again and again, and I don't want it to be too much of a mouthful as I pick up on it. The Skinner biotope comes from Skinner for stage, and biotope, an environment that provides a living place for a biological community. And this was coined by artist, philosopher, scientist, he's actually a marine biologist by training, Louis Beck, to designate, as you can see here, an artificial space, especially constructed to enhance the spectacular activities of organisms and models. Dispositif, this famous untranslatable word, an arrangement, a systems whose parameters can be manipulated. And particularly the third point, I think, is important for me, a space that's constructed quite precisely to study and amplify certain types of theatricalizing or theatricalized behaviors. So it's a concept that I've found very useful ever since Louis coined it. This was at the Avignon Festival back in 1990, and we've been engaged on developing it collaboratively ever since through practical workshops and theoretical exchange, working on these notions of staging living processes and behaviors and the resultant kinds of theatricality. I'm going to throw some slides up throughout this lecture that are not going to be commented on individually or specifically. So you'll have to treat them as a kind of a visual processing, parallel visual processing task. Some of them do have directly dealings with things I'll be talking about, others not. But I hope you'll forgive me for not laboriously hitching them in to what I'm actually going to talk about. They're on automatic pilot. And they're obviously rivaling with something that's been slightly left in the dark, but that's the disadvantage of being a classified painter of the late 18th century. You can't have hard light on you. Theatre scholarship is, of course, extremely diverse, and mine is focused on how theatre fires the collective imagination through specific kinds of live cultural experience that don't necessarily require dedicated architecture or infrastructure. Now, in light of my current remit, building or rebuilding dedicated architecture and infrastructure, this is perhaps quite a strong statement. But what I'd like to try and show with this lecture is how this approach, a broader approach to theatre and to the Skinner biotope, in fact makes the role of the Attenborough Centre even more important for the much wider stakeholder community reaching beyond traditional theatre that is involved in this particular venture. I believe that theatre's vocation is to creatively invest ad hoc sites and communications networks as well as established theatre buildings, which of course have all of their place as well in theatre. But part of the art of theatre involves shaping and testing our sense of place, our sense of something that the geographer Nigel Thrift has wonderfully called awareness, and that's spelt A-W-H-E-R-E-N-E-S-S. Thrift is actually talking about the emergence of layers of intelligence across biological and technological layers of life. But this sense of awareness allows us to identify places in which our cultural and imaginative values can be upheld, sites of resistance to the normative constraints of media that facilitate communications, as they must, by leveling difference. Communications are to do with standardized discourse, otherwise we can't communicate. What happens, of course, in some cases, is a loss of deeper poetic and idiosyncratic meaning. And this is where I think the role of the hard arts has to be affirmed categorically as what I like to call a mutagen for the imagination. I'm obviously not a scientist to be coming up with terms like this, but it seems to me that the arts feature as one of these very vital and capital domains for human existence that we're going into with the Sussex Conversations next year and that we're touching on this evening. James Barry, the painter here, in his day railed against what he saw as a dire tendency for the English cultural system to focus on readily repeatable mechanical arts. There are chunks of Barry's writings where he rails against this horribly repetitious, uninspired mechanical art that he feels England is investing in to the detriment of deeper, more thoughtful, and more poetic art. Barry felt that the artist should be focusing on flights of poetic fancy, knowledge, and deeper judgment. Of course, he has very late 18th century ways of couching this, and these are probably one of the reasons he was kicked out of the academy. But I think some of the things that Barry said about mechanical arts are very interesting to read again in the context of where we're going with, for example, creative industries, a highly ambiguous and sometimes slightly duplicitous concept for those of us working in the arts and across the arts and humanities. One certainly worth debating. We humans have a propensity for creatively projecting and modeling what technologies later make real. More specifically regarding the ways we engage with place, which is my subject this evening, theatre is full of conventions where discrete physical locations exist in parallel and or in rapid succession within symbolically staged arenas. As we rush to celebrate the novelty of pragmatic technological breakthroughs, for example, those networks that let us tailor our spatial environments by selectively channeling our communications networks across the planet, our long-standing and necessarily preceding creative aptitude to transform distances tends to be overlooked. In the opening lines of Sophocles' Electra, Pedagogus indicates landmarks to Orestes, who's returned to Mycenae to avenge his father's death. And he says, "Son of him who led our hosts at Troy of old, son of Agamemnon, there is the ancient Argos of thy yearning, that hallowed scene whence the gadfly drove the daughter of Inachus. And there, Orestes, is the Lycian Agora, named from the wolf-slaying god. And there, on the left, is Hera's temple. And in this place to which we have come, deem that thou seest Mycenae, rich in gold, with the house of the Pelopidae there, so often stained with bloodshed." It's astonishing. You have Argos, the Lycian Agora, Hera's temple, Mycenae with the house of the Pelopidae, four distinct sites conjured up in just a few lines by a single actor, possibly on an empty stage. This power over place is, of course, theatrical commonplace. And some of the images that you've seen earlier of different sorts of theatrical architectures, I think, show the extent to which we've been constantly molding and refashioning the place that we invest with theatrical energies. We've gone from open-air amphitheatres to rooms that have been sealed off and occluded as far as possible from any external influences, made entirely impermeable to sound and light so that we can rebuild sound and light within them. And then we've exploded them open again through technologies, through communication systems. And this movement across the theatrical membrane, the extent to which we make it permeable and impermeable, is a very fascinating historical movement. Theatre created by the ancients, the medieval and Renaissance dramatists, the Elizabethans, the Romantics, the moderns, the postmoderns, the posthumans, this theatre tends to reflect the artistic and technical resources of the times of these various cohorts. They're trying to provoke the collective imagination in their different contexts. I don't want to sound as though I'm saying that theatre has to be a showcase of the latest tricks, which does seem to be some people's readings of it. There's certainly an instance of it with the $65 million Spider-Man fiasco, this thing that simply cannot take off on Broadway. On the contrary, austere, low-tech creations may offer an even more meaningful contrast in a world so many of us experience as high-tech. History shows how techno-euphoria, like that surrounding today's high-bandwidth bandwagons, can trigger movements of resistance, a pendulum swing back to the bare boards art of the mountebanks, sharpening an age-old and productive tension between poor theatre of the street or the fairground and the royal machine room, the salle des machines. And you've seen some instances of the mountebanks alongside the royal salle des machines in these slides. Insofar as theatrical place and imagination, imaginative reach are tightly bound together, theatre makers must tune to the wider awareness in which their work is created and conveyed. How might our grasp of the multiple locations indicated by Pedagogus differ from that of Sophocles, given the potentially countless information windows that allow us from our homes today to simultaneously follow ongoing events in Japan, Libya, New Zealand? It seems that we rove most internationally for major crises or for sport. But then, of course, there's also CCTV relayed footage of our apartment building lobbies. And then at the other extreme, there's the deep space that's revealed by this heroic thing called Voyager, this 34-year-old artifact that's currently on a roll towards the heliopause in the cosmos. So we're encountered with this proliferation of spatial references and possibilities. And in this situation, how is it that we can generate visions worthy of Sophocles' mashup of Argos and Mycenae 2,500 years ago? How can we creatively challenge the scale and reach of perception we have so astonishingly attained, albeit with too much hubris at times? So these are questions of hard art. There's a French scholar I was lucky enough to work with called Bernard Dot, who used to encourage people concerned with these questions by quoting Émile Zola, a kind of an unlikely person to be quoting, one would think, the father of theatrical and literary naturalism. But Zola used to say, when you're asked, is this theatre, is that theatre, answer squarely, there's no such thing as theatre in the singular. There's theatre in the plural, and I'm looking for mine. And of course, that's a very nice one to pick up on. Recognition of the changing places in which theatre operates, on which Dort, I think, rightly suggests its viability depends, is, and I quote Dort, less a question of reflecting the current world in the too narrow mirror of the traditional stage than of anchoring theatrical activity in our society. This means that we have to find ways to map theatre's attributes across a shifting spectrum of activities in ever-transformed social contexts. And to test these mappings, we need places where we can push the limits of what it is that we're calling and accepting to call theatre. This is where infrastructure, like the Attenborough Centre, has a vital cultural contribution to make, a place for enriching shared understanding through experimentation, praxis, and critical debate in a radically interdisciplinary environment, which of course is a Sussex hallmark. Ideally positioned at the cusp of the academic institution and of the more informal social system that cultural theorist Florian Schneider calls the agilely networked ecstitution. So practice versus theory, viewing versus doing, watching versus listening, imitation, Plato's mimesis versus world building, Aristotle's diegesis, these are tensions and many others as well that haunt theatre scholarship, to the extent that one wonders how far we've let ourselves be culturally straitjacketed to exclusively value oppositional logics of the either-or type at the expense of logics of the both-and type, which would allow us, like Zola, to happily say that there are theatres in the plural. Opposing theatre as a place of speech where we can reason as articulate political animals, or so goes the myth, and theatre as a place of action based on the sensuous immediacy of specific stage languages, gesture, sound, matter, lighting, such oppositions can be frustratingly irrelevant when theatre so obviously and crucially reconciles all these attributes. Greek tragedy emerged from participatory Dionysiac rituals to become structured encounters where the response to the chorus by the first actor, the hypocrite, Crinane to give the response to criticize, acquired sufficient autonomy to warrant being observed by an increasingly passive audience. And this is, of course, an evolution that's wonderfully documented by Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy. When the protagonist, the first actor introduced by the strolling player Thespis, was joined by the second player, the deuteragonist, under Aeschylus, and then by the tritagonist, under Sophocles, what happened was that writing and staging became more complex at one and the same time, because richer dialogic possibilities obviously meant new visible and audible vectors for dramatic action, perceived by a public, placed at a distance, affording an overview, a view of what we call the bigger picture. Then, as ever since, theatre was plugged in to technological innovation. The machine that resolved Medea's fate, that was invented by Euripides, actually he is up there. According to descriptions of Barry's painting, he's sort of slightly second row behind the prancing white horse. It's quite hard to identify the characters in Barry's paintings because where he couldn't find resemblances of the time, of course, he found substitutes amongst the nobles and donors that he most needed to appease in his own day. But there were lots of sorts of theatre technology alongside, of course, this famous Mekani, the machine. There were Charon's stairs, which took you down to Hades or back up again if you were lucky. There was the Ekeklema, which was a wonderful sort of a zoom trolley on which you would stack a tableau vivant and wheel it up to the audience and haul it back again while they freaked out about this hallucination they'd just been witnessing. There were also periacts, there were rotating triangular systems to which one affixed emblematic notions of decor. So there was an incredible flexibility in the ways that one could deal with what looked like a fairly finite and technologically limited space. And I think this is where we need to be up on a par with the imagination of the so-called ancients. In any case, in the Greek arena, amphitheatre, spectacularly delivered, crafted dramatic discourse was certainly seen as much as it was heard. Yet clashes about the relative values of discursive and spectacular theatres are recurrent. They've been going on ever since, and they'll probably be going on forever. In late 18th century London, when the enlargement of Drury Lane and Covent Garden stages, a few hundred yards up the road, was decried by literati as making them henceforward theatres for spectators rather than playhouses for hearers, This was a quote from Richard Cumberland, who was a dramatic author of about 50 apparently rather mediocre sentimental comedies, but he was well heard and his opinion was well shared. Cumberland compared the refinement of English playwriting with the indiscriminate spectacle of what he called the vile Gallic stage. He was no doubt referring to the Boulevard du Temple, or the Boulevard du Crime, which was heaving with illiterate publics in Paris at the time. These were its best customers. And you must have seen earlier a painting by Louis-Léopold Boilly of the spectators in the box on a free day. Actually, the man who's hiding behind that screen, the Viscount Folkestone, was born Jacob de Bouverie, so I'm wondering how much he's been witness to this sort of cross-channel crossfire, which obviously I enjoy. More recently, in the latter part of the 20th century, theatre's role as an instrument of visual culture, because théâtron is the place from which one sees, was judged by many artists to be synonymous with conformist, authoritarian, discipline-bound institutions, hierarchically governed by sightlines and seating plans. And goodness knows that we're still struggling with these at the moment in any theatres we build. Baz Kershaw, author of a wonderful book called The Politics of Performance, speaks of performances in theatre buildings which are deeply embedded in theatre as a disciplinary system. So Kershaw is actually equating theatre with building and discipline and saying that the only good thing that can happen there is a performance, which doesn't necessarily have to happen in that building. Performance offers the critics of theatre a highly preferable conceptual framework for a certain type of embodied, time-bound, cross- and multimedia investigation of things like phenomenological presence, ritual, creative renderings of the everyday. Interestingly, the word performance has been much more readily adopted in the Anglo-Saxon world because it's much more etymologically loaded for the French. But thanks largely to a man called Richard Schechner, who was the New York founder of the Performance Group in 1967, and also the founder of this very broad field now known as performance studies, seriously helped by Routledge publications on this theme, performance has flourished as a rich interdisciplinary field. It spans social sciences, cultural anthropology, philosophy and rhetoric, human geography, media and gender studies, and so on. So, for example, the feminist Judith Butler, who was a recent Sussex guest lecturer, used performativity to describe the stylized defining of gender and sexuality in her milestone book, Gender Trouble. John McKenzie's Perform or Else compares performance across cultural, organizational, and technological sectors. So diverse uses of this term testify to the expansion of what has become an increasingly loaded concept. For this lecture, I've chosen to use the word live art. It's a helpfully loose term that rallies artists and theorists from theater, performance, and other practices, notably those associated with digital media, which challenge our notions of immediacy and presence in novel ways. It's a term that foregrounds concepts of liveness key to my research into theatre and technology. In the Live Art Development Agency's definition, it is described as having grown out of performance art methodologies and out of inquiries where artists broke the traditions of the circumstances and expectations of theatre. And Lada specifies that its interest is not with an art form or a discipline, but a cultural strategy to include experimental processes and experiential practices excluded from established cultural and critical frameworks. The places of live art are places where artistic license dissolves conventional distinctions between entities and environments, and more generally between the categories and hierarchies that govern our so-called real-world interactions. This opens up possibilities to generate registers of quasi or living presence, poetic taxonomies of more or less fictitious beings, places where it's just as legitimate to imagine the attributes of liveness as it is to prove them biologically, places where what Louis Beck calls fabulatory epistemology underpins freely creative recompositions of organisms and objects, living and inert materials, shapes and energies. Hybrids, of course, have always been a source of theatre's distinctive, prodigious vitality and poetic ambivalence, manifest through a lineage that includes totems and puppets, effigies and masks, automats and robots, and of course, in addition to the Euripidean mekane, robot is a theatrical word and invention. It comes from the Slavic word for forced labor, and a Czech playwright or writer, Karel Čapek, in 1920 wrote a play called Rossum's Universal Robots, which brought this word into existence. There are visionaries who've sought to re-endow these archaic non or pseudo or subhuman, often ritualized figures with theatrical force. And of course, these include Antonin Artaud, defender of the effigy and of alchemical theater, and also Edward Gordon Craig, who famously announced that for us to get beyond debased stage realism, the actor must go. He made a lot of friends when he announced that. Craig said the actor had to be replaced by an uber marionette, intended not to compete with life, but rather to go beyond it, not to be flesh and blood, but to clothe itself with a death-like beauty while exhaling a living spirit. Polish artist Tadeusz Kantor, creator of paintings, installations, and happenings, as well as stage works, who, like Craig, was a friend and subject of my research supervisor, Denis Bablet, wrote a manifesto called The Theatre of Death, which purported to go beyond Craig's uber marionette and to extract ready-made reality creations from life, integrating them artistically by, as he said, decision, gesture, or ritual, and using the mannequin as a model for the live actor. There's a director called Jean-François Piret who provocatively calls the actor the first Turing machine because of his or her mechanically assimilated, repeatable thought processes. In many ways, Craig Kantor's found actors manifest these startlingly mechanical behaviors. Kantor's objects, retrieved from the lowest rungs of reality, are staged to exert the same peculiar power as the most sophisticated of crafted hybrids. We all know that welling up of emotion, of terror, that's triggered in theater by a seemingly anodyne scrap of paper or a garment or something. A trivial thing that catches us out, that snares us with an overwhelming residue of uneasy meaning. And I think theater is a place for thinking about and conjuring up uneasy meaning. The lineage of theatrical hybrids, our quasi-living beings, or quasi-living beings, continues to develop vigorously with the computer-generated products of so-called mixed and augmented reality, artificial intelligence, artificial life, thriving like their analog forebears on the fringes of animism and artifact, building their creative critical mass from a mix of matter and informational energy, stuff and signal. Alongside developments in hard and software, biotechnology or wetware is literally seeding biologically live art, where creations like semi-living sculptures, for example, those produced by the Tissue Culture and Art Group at the University of Western Australia, use bioengineering to develop novel forms of time-based sculptural practice. To throw another of Louis Beck's neologisms into the mix, inventions like these dwell in the realm of techno-zoo-semiotics, a realm where communications, semiotics, mesh with the technological and zoos, the living. Nigel Thrift, writing on what he describes as new kinds of matterings, evokes augmented relationality across the skein of bodies, things, and spaces we inhabit. The infusion of something that in bygone language we might have called soul into simulacra or other models of possible lives no doubt bears out our deep yearning to celebrate the strangeness of the other and to give vent to the ritual impulses we've perhaps too lightly and quickly displaced and repressed in our gung-ho 21st century positivist zeal. But metaphysical questions aside, there are also some very pressing and pragmatic reasons for us to exploit our creative abilities to implement new kinds of dramaturgical encounters. Given the extent to which digital information triggering and gathering processes have now irrevocably outstripped our normal cognitive ability to make use of their harvest, such encounters are now needed to help us grasp the seething universe of drama, to which we're henceforth exposed. As a concrete, real-world example of this need, we can look at libraries. To read 1 million books, apparently, it takes 40 generations, 1,000 years. Harvard's Widener Library, the world's biggest, contains about 16 million. Digital humanities scholars are suggesting that it's urgent for us to invent new kinds of on-the-fly, adaptable, customizable, recombinant data management systems that will allow books to read and talk to one another. We could then glean the forms of knowledge that transpire through these dialogues of our information resources come agents. This, of course, implies, first and foremost, building agents that we trust. Naturally, we all trust our fellow humans, totally. But more crucially, with respect to theatre and live art, and to my subject here, it implies that we have to find ways to impart coherent, compelling agency to the resources we're creating in order to deal with them productively and to have productive dealings with them. In other words, we need to stage readily comprehensible dialogic bridges between existential types that normally don't speak to each other. Just as Thespis, Aeschylus, and Sophocles introduced novel vectors for dramatic exchange that enriched reflection on the ancient Greek universe, so now we need to invent agents and vectors for narratives that can help us to fathom our techno-zoo-semiotic universe. And it seems to me that it's only by nurturing our storytelling, theatricalizing activities and capacities, by forging the terms of hitherto impossible discourse, that we can meaningfully engage with this complex skein of bodies and things and spaces to which we belong. A second argument in support of wider interdisciplinary, intercultural approaches to theatre pertains to the recently established RoboEarth. This is a kind of Wikipedia for robots. It's being developed by Marcus Weibel and his colleagues at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. The goal is to let robots share and store and therefore more effectively function, sharing what they discover about the world. So this is a huge step, epistemologically and ethically, from the Internet of Things that was announced by the MIT in 1999, which had to do with the networked interconnection of everyday objects. Now we're talking about the Internet of Things that control things. The real question for us is, what is our status in this system? Are we things too? And is this just another rendering of that old story of humans being taken over by another species, the story of Chapek's play on Rossum's Universal Robots, or the ancient myths that Hollywood recycles so expertly, Terminator, Transformer? Or is it something of a very different nature? Hard questions, again, requiring sharpened creative insights. That is, if we wish to more fluently navigate the codes and machines we've so cheerfully crafted without imagining that one day they might become bored with us and prefer to develop their own collective online spaces, robo-earth, their own metaverses. Three decades ago, Glaswegian anthropologist Victor Turner, in his book on ritual and theatre, The Human Seriousness of Play, suggested that new communicative techniques and media may make possible wholly unprecedented genres of cultural performance, new modes of self-understanding. Turner's vision certainly seems to have been fulfilled. Unprecedented genres of performance are emerging fast, including amongst the matterings and intelligencings of our rapidly evolving techno-zoo-semiotic world. And they are beginning to look for modes of self-understanding. The question is, are we humans sufficiently concerned with seeking ways to understand them and thence ourselves? As cultural beings by nature, because we are natural beings by culture, a wonderful boutade from Edgar Morin, where do these shifting sands of real and artificial life leave us? I see artists as passeurs, as go-betweens, whose intuitive leaps are inspired by what Beck calls a curious idiosyncrasy to create utopian worlds. Creative extremophiles, haunted by exploratory tropisms, by the irresistible attraction for vague and dangerous zones, inhabited by the inclination to exceed or overturn taboos, limits, frontiers. Today, as we encode and decode the genome and plan major cosmic excursions by modeling travel to and from Mars, for example, we're engaged in a vast fabric of research that challenges prior notions of what it means to be human to a much greater degree than ever before. Living human beings. The ability to share such questions appears crucial if notions of humanity and collective responsibilities as a species are to have any meaning. Theatre, live art, and the Skinner biotope have a valuable and vital cultural role to play, offering sites for modelling and collectively entertaining otherness. While it is our exploratory tropisms, our propensity to construe and to construct previously inconceivable things that have built and hurtled us into this complex techno-zoo-semiotic universe, our survival nonetheless remains tightly and circuitously dependent on sustaining the ability to craft truly moving, shareable symbolic systems. And this, I believe, is the lasting and irreplaceable function of theatre. Thank you.